And what I ultimately settled on was, just because the world underestimates us doesn't mean our fate is pre-written, because every single person that came to work for us, 90% of us, were underestimated in some way, shape, or form. A chick shouldn't own a hardware store. Someone with 17 years in prison shouldn't be helping the public. Someone with a crystal meth addiction. You name it. Like, we heard every negative about all of the things we were gonna try to do, but our fate.
It still hits. I don't miss it. It's go, go, go. Like a go, go flow. And I'm almost done. And I told y'all so. When I throw these flows, like it's Rochambeau. And I ain't too close. It's Joe Smo Girls. And I'm on my grind. That is all the time. I do not do breaks. That's right. I stay in dry. And look, I'm back with a little bit of that. A little more cash than I came in with. Ready, that cat is out that bag. But I still ask, the boy got skills. I don't need her. I don't need him. I don't need help with me. I got this. I can sing songs. I can spit raps. And I can do both. Even do this. Word.
This episode is brought to you by Sweat Tent, the pioneers of the portable wood-burning sauna. Did you know that using the sauna 3 to 4 times per week could reduce your risk of cardiovascular disease by up to 50% and make you 60% less likely to experience Alzheimer's disease? That's why I've been a big fan of the sauna for years. But having to go to a crowded gym to do it isn't ideal. And all the at-home options are bulky and expensive. That's why I only use the Sweat Tent for my sauna needs. It's the most storable and affordable wood-burning sauna on the market. It not only takes minutes to set up, but it can reach 200 degrees Fahrenheit in 30 minutes or less. So whether you're enjoying it yourself in your backyard, with friends, or in need of a reliable sauna on the go, Sweat Tent is your best choice for the most portable, storable, and enjoyable outdoor sauna experience. All On The Stacks listeners will receive $100 off when you use code OTS. Visit sweattent.com today to get $100 off your purchase with code OTS at checkout. Again, that's sweattent.com to get $100 off with code OTS. Sweat Tent, helping you fire up your home wellness routine.
This episode is brought to you by FitAF. If you haven't already noticed, I live and breathe entrepreneurship. Whether it's launching new ventures, attending pitch meetings, or mentoring budding entrepreneurs, my schedule is jam-packed. And that's where FitAF steps in. Their menu changes weekly, offering a variety of chef-inspired meals designed by nutrition experts using only the best quality ingredients, keeping me fueled and focused. Their vast selection of meals has you covered for all types of dietary restrictions and diet plans, including keto, paleo, vegetarian, vegan, gluten-free, and more. As an On The Stacks listener, enjoy our exclusive offer. Get 20% off your first order of 7 meals or more when you use code OTS at checkout at fitafnutrition.com. Again, that's code OTS for 20% off your first order of 7 meals or more at fitafnutrition.com. Healthy meals and seamless nutrition, keeping entrepreneurs at the top of their game.
What's up, podcast? I'm your host, Bill Corcoran Jr. here in the Sweat 10 studio. Gina Schaefer, welcome to the On The Stacks podcast.
Thank you for having me.
This is exciting. We had a little bit of a rocky start. I'm a few hundred episodes into this show, and you think by now I would have I'd have the technology part figured out. And you know, it's kind of just like life. You know, sometimes you get thrown curveballs at the last second, and you just have to figure it out on the fly. And it only took us a few minutes, but we figured it out.
It's always how you roll with it. Seriously.
Right.
Like, that's how you get through life. Yeah.
I know. And, we had spoken one other time prior to this, but, you know, of course, hopping on here, I hop on and we're doing the, can you hear me now? Can you hear me now? Kind of thing. And I'm like, here I am. I'm all embarrassed. I'm like, oh man, I'm the podcaster. I'm showing up. You know, she's got this beautiful setup. Everything's perfect. The picture, the audio and everything. And then here's me. I'm like, you know, All you see is my mouth going and you're just going, you know, doing one of these. And, but we, yeah. Can you hear me now? Kind of thing. So, but yeah, so we made it. We're all set now. Where are you? Are you in DC?
I am. Yeah. I'm 5 blocks from the Capitol. So I live on Capitol Hill. Yep.
Oh, you're right in the thick of it there.
Right in the thick of it.
Oh
yes.
Man. So are you born and raised down there?
No, I was born and raised in Northeastern Ohio. I moved to DC in 93. So, I mean, I've been here longer than I was in Ohio at this point, which kind of makes me old, but yeah, I feel like a native.
Yeah. What was the move? What made you move there?
I came after college. I came to work for a nonprofit. I was talking to someone recently about that job because every once in a while I'll say something that seems or feels or is actually like politically correct in my language, but I worked for a nonprofit called the Children's Defense Fund, and our executive director said, kids are baby goats, not the human beings we're serving. And so we could never use the word kid when we were talking about the people that we were taking care of. So yeah, I think I'm probably in the right place.
Yeah. No, that's great. Did you, you know, obviously we'll get to the hardware, you know, part of your story and all that, but leading up to that in your life, like what was your vision when you were, you know, right out of college? Like what did you think you were going to do?
Well, I mean, I thought I was going to save the world. Doesn't every young person, I was going to move here. I was going to work for this big nonprofit. I wanted to be a fundraiser. I had political aspirations. I grew up wanting to be a governor, which is hysterical because I moved to the one place in the United States that doesn't have a governor. So that was silly. I followed the executive director of this nonprofit. She was the speaker at my graduation, and I really just idolized her. And then I got here, and I wouldn't say I became disillusioned, but I turned 25, and I affectionately call it my quarter life crisis. And I was like, I'm out of here. And I moved to Brazil.
Moved to Brazil.
So I did. I moved to Brazil. We had hosted a bunch of exchange students when I was growing up, and five were Brazilian. So it wasn't so random that that's the country that I picked.
So you had somewhat of a connection.
I had connections. I went and lived with the family of my favorite. We still call each other sisters, but she was actually living in California at the time. So I took her childhood bedroom, lived with her parents, who were divorced and still lived together. Like the whole relationship was hilarious. And I taught English for about 10 months before I came back.
Wow. Well, so that was like, it was like a total full circle thing for you. So like, you know, you know, it's like they returned the favor.
Yes, that's exactly. Well, yeah, that's exactly what happened. And I went from a town of 7,000 to a college town of 70,000 to DC, which had 700,000 to São Paulo, which I think was probably like 14 million or something ridiculous. And so I just kept getting bigger. My world kept getting bigger.
Yeah. So what was that experience like?
I mean, well, it was crazy. It was such a huge city and it was a huge eye opener. And, you know, the interesting thing about São Paulo is that you can have favelas, which are their shanty towns, right next to really expensive high rises. And so everyone sort of coexists, which is a very eye opening experience. I grew up in a very, I said, small town. Everyone was basically the same. Everyone was middle class. My dad worked for a factory, as did all my uncles, all my friends' dads. And then all of a sudden I was living in this like super posh high rise that was surrounded by a shanty town. And so just that visual was really eye opening for me. I took the bus everywhere, and São Paulo is so busy that I was literally on the bus for hours every day, getting back and forth to where I needed to go to teach English or, you know, just go shopping, do whatever it is that I was going to do. So that was weird, using public transportation, hearing a foreign language, you know, all day long, which will force you to learn it pretty quickly.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Yeah. So there was a McDonald's across the street from the condo that I lived in, which I always thought was really funny because it was a little taste of home, but I don't eat meat. So I wasn't even going there to get a taste.
Yeah. So it was pointless. Yeah.
It was pointless, but it was weird. Like in this place that there was a McDonald's at the time. So anyway, it was really cool. I loved it.
So you said you were only there for about a year?
Yeah. A little less. The visa was reciprocal like the United States. And so I could only stay for 6 months.
Okay.
And I overstayed it by about four. I thought I was going to get thrown in jail when I left. But I really didn't want to leave. And finally I was like, all right, I can't deal with the stress of how long I've overstayed.
Yeah.
And so I came back.
Yeah. So what was the plan then? I mean, when you were coming back, did you have like kind of like a next plan, or were you just kind of like, I'm just going to figure it out when I get back?
I think I really thought I was going to figure it out when I got back. I mean, I had left a strong group of friends here, mostly in the nonprofit world, but we were still all young. It's not like, I mean, I had connections, but it's not like they were in the hiring seats at this point. So I thought I'd probably come back and work for some nonprofits. And then I met this woman who I affectionately nicknamed Quabs, Queen of Bullshit, because she could sell anything to anybody. And she got me a job at this tech company. Because she had a client, her client was IBM Latin America, and she convinced them that they needed someone on the project that spoke Spanish and Portuguese. And then me, like this total non-techie, geeky chick, shows up and was like, I speak Spanish and Portuguese. And so I went to work for this tech company. She had to teach me how to use my computer.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. That's
now
crazy.
That really makes me sound old. It's not like I had, you know, this was then.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That was that time frame.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So. Yeah. You mentioned like a little bit about your family and kind of like your background a little. So like where does the entrepreneur in you, like where did that come from?
So I wrote a book, which is, we can talk about later, but I talk in the book about my mom being very entrepreneurial because she had a beauty shop. I keep using air quotes, like a beauty shop is what they were called at the time, in our basement. And little old ladies would come and they would get their hair cut every week, or they'd get like blue rinses and pin curls put in their hair. And so my mom did that to make extra money. And then she like sewed things and made things that she sold to the little old ladies that came to get their hair their hair done. So a little bit of it was necessity. She was raising two young kids, and my dad worked, he worked the midnight shift at the Hoover factory and then drove a school bus during the day. So there was no way she could work outside of the house if she couldn't take my brother or I somewhere or, you know, afford daycare. And so she just did things at home. I think a lot of it came from her just watching a little bit of that side hustle when I was growing up, although we never called it that then, right? It was, it was survival.
You know, it's funny you say that, because, you know, you look at it now, right? And I feel like almost everybody has a side hustle, right? Like, but again, back, you know, like when you were growing up, it wasn't really looked at like that. I wonder why that is. Any thoughts around that?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's funny. And her generation was always looked at differently as the housewife, right? So they were doing what they could in the house, and they weren't really thought of as jobs. I don't know. That's a really good question. I mean, I don't know when that term was coined. I feel like Uber came about and all of a sudden side hustle was a thing. And so maybe there was a different word for it. And I don't know what it is.
Yeah, maybe we just don't know. Maybe there was something and you weren't calling it that. But it is really interesting to think about. You know, it's, same thing. You know, my family looking back, you know, everybody kind of still, not everybody, but a lot of people did have, you know, what we call a side hustle, even back then. And a lot of times those side hustles then turned into the full-time thing, or maybe sometimes, not all the time, but it did exist, I'll say, you know, years ago. And, but, you know, may not have been just referred to it, like you said, may not have been referred to it as we refer to it now. I think nowadays you see a lot of people and families, and even people that don't have families that still need the side hustle to survive.
It's a fact of life for a lot of people, and it's a badge of honor also, I think, for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. When I remember, I was in college and my high school boyfriend went to Stanford and I stayed in Ohio to go to college. And so we were across the country from each other, and I had to have my first side hustle in college because that was when you still had to pay long distance phone bills. And he and I racked up this really high phone bill and we couldn't afford to pay it.
Oh no.
So I started sewing like hair scrunchies to sell to all of the women in my dorm because I don't know what was going to happen to me, but I couldn't pay the phone bill and I couldn't ask my parents for the money. Like they would have had a fit if they knew how much money we were racking up in phone bills. Yeah. That was my first side
hustle. How much was it?
I mean, I remember it being like $200 or something, and that might as well have been $2 million at the time.
Yeah, pretty much. So, and especially as a you know, a younger kid student, like that's a lot of money.
Yeah,
you know,
it's a lot. Yeah.
So you worked it off, and it all worked out.
I paid the bills.
Did you do anything? You know, it just reminds me. You know, because now I'm thinking back to, you know, I'll say like my childhood as a teen, and then throughout college and stuff. So, you know, I did a lot of like random and sold things like that too, you know, but was there anything else that maybe you did before that or even after that as just like almost like another little side hustle?
Yeah, this is one of my favorite stories. So I told you we had those exchange students stay with us, and I wanted to go when I was 16, I wanted to go live in Brazil for a year with my favorite exchange student. And so I was going to go, and my parents at the last minute were like, you can't do it. We're not going to let you leave for a year. And I was crushed. And they said, but you can go for 2 months over the summer and you can stay with Fabiana's her name. You could stay with Fabiana's family, but you have to pay for it. And so I went to there was an oil field in the town that I grew up in, and all of the juniors and seniors would drink there, and they were just slobs, and they would throw their cans into the field. And so every Saturday and Sunday morning, I would drive my little car to the oil fields and I would pick up all of the cans. So stupid. But I went, you know, you could take the cans in and get money for it.
Yeah.
And so every Saturday and Sunday, I had a Caprice little, like, I think it was this Caprice Classic. It was this little white car. And I would fill it with cans from the oil field, and I would drive it all the way to the weigh station, and I would come home with, I mean, it was probably $10. It wasn't much.
Yeah, but still, it was something. But, I think I did it. I did it myself too, even as a teen. I've done it too. Yeah,
I think collected cans.
Yeah, I've done the thing with the cans. Yeah, 100%.
I love it.
Yeah,
yeah, we were the original recyclers. We were so green and we didn't know it.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you go to the shady recycling center, you know, and it was always like grimy and gross and everything else. But But hey, you walked out of there with like 10 or 20 bucks and you felt rich, right?
I went straight to the bank. Like I went to the bank every single day, no matter how much money I'd made in tips the night before at the restaurant I worked at or in cans I picked up. Yeah.
So when you say tips, so you worked in the restaurant industry?
Yeah. I loved waiting tables. I worked at a family restaurant, but I think my tips at the time, I mean, I would go home with $1.50 and I think it was a big deal because mm-hmm. a quarter or 50 cents. I mean, I'm not 100 years old. That makes me sound like I'm 100 years old. But, you know, in those small family restaurants, a dinner might have been $10. Mm-hmm. And so people, maybe they would leave me a dollar. And so it didn't add up very much every night.
Yeah. Yeah. I always find I never personally worked in the restaurant industry, but I did work some retail, you know, a couple of retail jobs in high school, college and right after college. But what I always whenever anyone ever says that they worked in, you know, as a server or a bartender, everybody always has. Well, number one, they have crazy stories, first of all.
Yes.
And then number two, everybody always says like it was probably one of the best experiences and has really taught them a lot, usually about people. Yeah. Is that hold true for you, too?
Totally. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I had a retail job in college just briefly, like over a summer, which was funny thinking back on that when I ended up going into retail as my career. But I think waiting tables, I mean, first of all, you learn how to multitask, talk to all kinds of people, different walks of life, different attitudes and personalities, different sets of expectations. You know, you can have somebody that's really nice sitting next to a table with someone who's really demanding and, you know, figuring out how to balance those personalities without losing your cool. Mm-hmm. was a great learning experience.
Yeah. Yeah. It usually is. And kind of, you know, just figuring things out on the fly and just, you know, keeping everybody at bay, trying to keep everybody happy. Cause that's, everybody has, to one level or another, obviously experienced, you know, both the good and the bad, you know, of being at a restaurant and, you know, it's not always any one person's fault. Right.
Nope.
It's one of those things where, you know, it's super awkward and everybody feels bad and nobody knows what to do or what to say. And it's just trying to keep the peace is a very difficult challenge.
Especially when you're young. I mean, people don't necessarily teach you those skills. Like the bosses at the restaurants would teach you how to serve the food or talk about it, but they didn't really give you the soft skills that you needed to handle difficult customers or manage your time really well. And so, I mean, I think I must have been pretty good at it. I'm not trying to sound cocky, but like I did it a lot when I needed extra money. But looking back on it, I'm like, I don't know how I did it so well because no one gave me those soft skills.
Yeah, you just figured it out as you went?
Yeah, I did. Well, and thank goodness because when I moved to DC to work for that nonprofit, it was an unpaid, like they would let anybody work there, but they wouldn't pay them. Mm. It was called an internship.
Right.
So I had to wait tables. Yeah, I had to wait tables to pay my rent. And that also meant that I got free meals. And so I could take home a meal one night that I could make last for two meals.
Yeah, right. Got to stretch.
And then I could pay my rent. So
yeah,
having those, that wouldn't have happened in a retail business. Basically.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. And clearly that experience served, no pun intended, served you well because, you know, you then were able to utilize that skill again, you know, like you said, to be able to pay your rent. And in a situation like that, like to be able to do what you wanted to do. You had to be a server, but you figured it out and you made it work.
Yep.
And you know, the rest is history. So, but like I said, I always find anyone that ever worked in the restaurant industry, they always usually have very, very similar stories and, you know, usually humbling stories and stories of, very similar to yours where it's like, hey, you just had to figure it out and learn as you go. And it's probably one of the greatest experiences you've ever had that probably
so good.
Have served you well and probably still serves you very well to this day, if I had to guess.
Well, I think, so two things. I think it, when you are, when you're on the other side of the equation now and you're a customer in a restaurant, you know how you wish you had been treated. And
right.
I think those of us who have done it, I think are better customers mm-hmm. in a lot of ways, not everybody, certainly. But the other thing is my dad was really afraid for a while that I was going to become a career waitress. And there's nothing wrong with that. But I liked it so much. And he's like, we spent a lot of money for you to go to college. Please find something else you want to do. Like, you don't want to be waiting tables your whole life. And of course, he had never eaten in restaurants like we have in D.C. where they're making $100,000 a year in tips.
Yeah.
So he hadn't had that visual yet, right? So
yeah.
He was like, she's going to be... It's going to be hand to mouth for a long time if she decides she's going to keep waiting tables. So mm-hmm. I didn't.
Yeah. 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 No, like I said, you can make a lot of money, but it's also one of those things that you know, could take a toll on you physically, mentally. I mean, absolutely. Really any job really can. But I think, you know, obviously some certain, you know, jobs and careers, you know, certainly could do that a little bit more so than others. You know, so I think one of the other things, and you kind of sort of maybe touched on it, but maybe is empathy. I think, you know, like just like you said, we've all been in that position, and you know how you want to be treated. And yes. I think, you know, one of the takeaways I imagine you also got is, you know, you learned how to empathize with people because, you know, you've seen both sides of it. And that goes with really anything in life. I often find that a lot of times when people don't have empathy towards a certain situation, that maybe that you're going through or that somebody else is going through, it's a lot of times, you know, we all get frustrated and be like, ah, oh, why isn't that person, like, why don't they give a shit? And it's like, well, when you take the step back and you really pick it apart, I always find that it's usually that person. It's not that they maybe so much don't care or that they're an asshole. It's really almost not that, but it's usually they just haven't experienced what you have, so they don't know how to handle it. And
yep, it's no exposure.
They may not have been exposed to that type of scenario or that situation, and you know, again, we've all been there, and you know, a lot of times we get frustrated and upset with other people, like thinking like, oh, why can't this person, like, why isn't this person like engaged with, like, why, you know, I'm thinking to myself like, what the hell's wrong with them? Why don't they have empathy for the situation? And you know, more times than not, it ends up being like they just haven't been in that situation, so they don't know how to relate, they don't know what to say. You know, I still think there's still some ways, you know, for those people maybe to, you know, even if you say like, hey, listen, I don't know what you're going through. I could still, you know, hey, I'm here, yes, whatever. But a lot of those conversations are very hard and difficult to have, especially in time of crisis, whether you're going through one or, well, small or big. But I think that's another one, is empathy. And I think, you know, especially in business, I think empathy is one of the it's really important. I mean, I think it's so important to be able to have empathy for anyone and to be able to relate to people and still have those difficult conversations. I think it goes a long way, especially in relationship building.
Oh yeah, for sure. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt
you. No, you're good.
I use the phrase non-traditional teacher to describe a lot of my teammates, like people who had never had a formal teaching education, but something that they did or pointed out to me taught me how to be a better leader. And then I always say, and a better person. And you've probably experienced this with some of your guests. Like, someone had an experience that was so far out of your realm of understanding or your life, and you're like, wow, I just, you know, and then like a switch flips and you can't unempathize or you can't ununderstand what that person is trying to explain. It's amazing. I mean, I could give you a million examples of where this comes into play, but like, I was just talking about one of my teammates the other day who told me once that it's better to be respected than liked. I grew up in a small town in Ohio. I was a people pleaser. My parents said, be nice to everybody. You want everyone to like you. And then you get into business and that attitude doesn't always work.
No.
Like, I found myself in situations where they could have thought I was an asshole, but they had to listen to me or respect me or, you know, follow some instructions. And I remember the day Eric said that to me and I was like, oh my God, that's what I was missing, was that one piece. But he was one of those non-traditional teachers. No one would have expected him with his background really to make such an impact. And he did.
Yeah. How did you, you know, as an individual, how did you work through that people pleaser where you said, like, you know, just like you know, you were told by your parents, hey, be nice to everybody. You know, same thing. I grew up in a small town. So I'm born and raised in the town that I'm in. And, you know, very similar, where it's a small town. Everybody knows everybody. And it's kind of one of those same things where, you know, you piss off the wrong person. And then it's like,
and everybody knows.
Yes, it could do a lot of harm for a long time, right? Like, so how did you manage and deal with that and get through that?
Well, I mean, I think that I'm probably still figuring out how to manage and deal with it. But one of the things that we did early on at the company was create our core values. And so it gave us some common language because nobody has the same upbringing. I mean, my first teammate had been in prison for 17 years. There was no reason for me to think that my values and his values were coming from the same place just because our childhoods had been so different. And so we created the core values so we could have some conversations about what does it mean to communicate respectfully? What does it mean to be a good neighbor? I hired this kid once who was 14. I was only allowed because of some rules, but I offered him a job not knowing how young he was. And he couldn't answer any of the questions. Like, he had never had a job. I came to find out no one in his family had ever had a job. They had always been on public assistance. And I finally said, tell me about a time you were a good neighbor, because that's one of our core values. And he lit up and he was so excited to tell me about a neighbor he helped, just like flipping, you know, Mayberry. And that was the commonality. And so I think using those values as a framework was helpful. Having some expectations that we held everyone to gave us some boundaries. And it also was good for me. And this is a like a sort of an aside example, but people ask us for donations all the time. And I always wanted to say yes. I didn't want to make anybody mad. But we finally created a framework so that if you, for example, ask me outside of a 45-day window, I could say, sorry, you have to give us 45 days notice. And you knew that because I needed the boundaries.
Right.
Otherwise, I was going to figure out a way to say yes to you, whether we could afford it or not. So that helped.
Yeah. Yeah. So, all right. So you mentioned about hiring, you know, some of you said the gentleman that was in prison. What's the background story there?
Yeah. So, at the time, so this was 2003 when we opened our first store, it was still legal to have the felony box on an application. And I think it's still legal in 12 states to ask if somebody has a felony in their background. And I remember getting sort of this canned application I took it from another company or something. And I looked down at that question. I was like, that's kind of rude. So many people have told me since then, that's the weirdest way to look at it. But I was like, I don't want to ask this question. So I scratched it off the application. And Tommy came in and applied for a job. And there was someone in the neighborhood who gave him a good reference. And I was like, okay. Like, I didn't ask him. And he was amazing. He worked with us for 10 years and everybody loved him. And I didn't know until, I don't know how long it was before, you know, we started building this really open culture where people were just free to talk about life's experiences. And it finally came out at some point that he had been in prison. And my husband remembers hearing that it was 17 years. I don't even remember if Tommy told me that at one point, but that's how it started. It was me thinking the question was rude. Somebody amazing applying for a job who might have never gotten a job anywhere else if people had seen that felony box checked.
Sure.
All worked out well.
Yeah. Yeah. So how did you get into the hardware business?
I got laid off from my tech job. So I went from Brazil to technology and it was like the mid to late 90s boom and bust in the tech world. I got laid off, I don't know, three times, I think. And I lived in a neighborhood that had nothing. Like there was maybe a sandwich shop and a pawn shop, basically, and a healthcare clinic. And the neighbors really wanted a hardware store. And the third time I got laid off, I said, I can open a hardware store. So I did.
So Ace Hardware. So how does it take me back a little? Like, how did you decide, like, how did this all work out?
So there are no hardware franchises in the United States. Most people don't know that. Ace is a cooperative. Mm-hmm. And so I sent an email to Ace and True Value, which is most people will recognize True Value. They're no longer a cooperative, unfortunately, but Ace sent a new business development guy to talk to me about opening in our community. And he told me to sign my lease before I got approved to be a member of the cooperative. I signed an almost $2 million lease. He lied to me. I was supposed to get approval from Ace first before I signed the lease. And they said, well, you've got a lease. Let's see what happens. So that's really the long story short. But Logan Circle had been destroyed by the riots when Martin Luther King was assassinated. And so when those riots ended, basically all of the businesses went away. It had been this really vibrant, diverse community in the middle of Washington, and everybody left. Like there were 1,000 people that were either thrown in jail or injured or arrested. And then the businesses were gone. And then people started moving back two decades later because it was a cheap place to live. You know, like a lot of cities have gone through. Yeah. The artists could move in first, or the young people could move in because the houses were really cheap and apartments were cheap. And that was me. I needed a place to live. And so I bought a condo that was ridiculously inexpensive compared to how it would be now.
Sure.
And got involved in the community association. And everyone was like, oh my God, we need a hardware store because we're all fixing up these houses and condos. So, yeah.
Wow. So all right. So you opened the first one. So, I mean, you scaled it pretty quick from what I understand.
Yeah, we opened. So my husband joined me after I opened that first store. He decided that he was going to quit his tech job and be part of the business, which is so great. And we went from one to two in 2 years, and then we opened one a year for 10 years, and then a smattering after that. So all told, we've had 15. We've had to close two that didn't work. We purchased five from retiring owners, and we built 10 from scratch. So we have dabbled in a variety of ways of opening. We've had to close. We've had well, we have 275 teammates. We flex to about 300 in the busy season. We're selling our business to our team. So about 130 of them are co-owners now, which is super cool.
That is cool.
Yeah. And we'll keep, I retired as CEO, but the business will keep growing. And so we went from, like I said, 1 to 10 in about 11 years, and then a smattering after that for the next 10 years or so. And then we'll just, we'll keep going from here.
Was what, when you first got into it, I mean, was it your plan to scale like you did?
I wish I remembered. Like, I wish I had some stupid diary or something that said, Gina, you're going to, you know, you're going to have 100 stores one day. I really don't know. I mean, I will tell you this. It didn't take long for us to want to grow because people were coming in from all over the city asking us if we would open in their neighborhood. So we, within like 6 or 8 months, we're like, we might be on to something. And that was really before we had the stress of the big box stores, and there weren't any in Washington at the time. But we didn't have really the threat of the internet that we had. And so the landscape was wide open for us to continue to open. And I think I probably would have gotten pretty bored with just being in one location at the same time.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
World
domination was in my future.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So you talked about, you mentioned a couple that didn't work out. So, you know, I always, you know, the failures, I think are, everybody has a lot to learn from, you know, other people's mistakes or failures, however you want to look at it. Right. But, I'd love to talk about that for a minute and just, you know, see what, you know, kind of from your perspective, like what went wrong, you know, what did you learn from it? And how did you sort of, you know, break that off and be able to move forward? Like how did that work? Cause I'm sure obviously, you know, everybody says like, oh, you can't have emotion in business, but yet, as we all know, there still is to a degree, especially, you know, when it's your thing, there's people involved. I mean, there's a lot at stake. So what was that experience like for you?
Well, first of all, we had legally binding leases that our landlords wouldn't let us out of. So we ran both of them for 10 years until we could close them, which meant the other businesses were technically subsidizing running them, which, you know, you talk about emotion. There's certainly the emotional part of it, but there's also the financial toll that it takes, the financial emotion that it takes, because we didn't want to bankrupt. We could have bankrupted them, but we didn't want it to jeopardize any future loans we were going to get for expansion. So I would say there's a lot of lessons, and there were a lot of, like you said, good things that came out of it. But the first one, we broke all of the rules. The first one was our fifth location. So the first four were super successful, and then we opened our fifth one. And by then, we had created some pretty solid rules about where and how we wanted to open. So we wanted a neighborhood with a shop local sense of shop local. We wanted a neighborhood with a strong identity. We didn't want there to be any competition. And then we opened this location in a neighborhood that didn't even have a name. We named it after the street because the community didn't have a name because there really was no community. And so in hindsight, we're like, damn it, we made these great rules and then we just ignored all of them. So that's one thing, like don't break your rules if your rules are good. And the second one was store number, I think 13, and I should know that. But we wanted to try doing a teeny tiny store because rents in DC are ridiculously high. We couldn't get space in every neighborhood that we wanted to be in at the size we wanted it to be. So we're like, let's try this express model. And it had all of the bells and whistles of the bigger stores, but it was like 3,000 square feet. And so I'm really glad we tried, but I think part of the problem was the size. I think those two things, I mean, the first one teaches you not to break your rules, your own rules. And the second one taught us to not be afraid to try new things, but you have to be aware that there might be some pretty crappy consequences. You never know. Yeah. So we also, the first one that failed, we started hosting ladies' nights. And we did that because we thought, well, let's just throw a party and see if we can get people to come. And there were other hardware stores around the country that were hosting these ladies' nights. And it was wildly successful. We had like 350 people there, like wall to wall. It was almost uncomfortable how crowded it was, but it never moved the needle. So we thought, well, maybe we're still on to something that we can replicate in our other stores. And so it set us down on this path of hosting really big events multiple times a year at our stores. Thousands of people come to our events and they're good. They work. That idea came out of that store that failed and it just didn't work for that store.
Yeah. What was that like being, you know, two things, number one, woman in business, and number two, being a woman in the hardware industry?
Yeah. So I'm a little bit of an oddity. There are lots of great women in the hardware industry across the country, but hardware in general is historically multi-generational, that usually goes from grandfather to father to son. And so that's really how, you know, the cooperatives tracked. They tracked it through the male lineage. Everything's sort of male centric. I would go to trade shows and really the vendors wouldn't talk to me because they were like, we don't, you know, her dad must be around, or her husband must be around here somewhere.
Or they just thought like, oh, she's lost. She's not the owner, right?
Yeah. Why is she wandering around this trade show floor? So, that was tough. The one thing that really worked to our advantage though, is the media thought it was cool as shit that there was a woman that owned a hardware store. And so the amount of press that we got in the beginning was incredible. In fact, my husband's name is Mark. And one day Mark's dad said, how come you're never on camera? First of all, he never wants to be on camera. And second of all, he's like, are you kidding? Like, this is magic. When she talks, people are like, we're going to go see the lady owned hardware store. And so, I mean, and for several months it was before he joined me, but then it became a family thing. So I would say I really used that to our advantage.
Yeah. I mean,
it also made the team a lot more diverse because I wasn't like, I wanted to have women on my team and I wanted to have people of color on my team. And I wanted that I really think that mentality came from the fact that we were getting a lot of support by just starting from a place of diversity, to be honest.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I was I was reading up on you. It says that your journey highlights the power of resilience, community driven business models, and inclusive hiring practices. I think you kind of touched on it a little bit there, but I'd love for you to expand on that some.
On the Stacks will be back in a flash after a word from our sponsor.
This episode is brought to you by Elevation Wellness, NEPA's premier wellness center located on Mundy Street in Wilkes-Barre. From pro athletes to busy parents, Elevation Wellness is leading the conversation when it comes to bettering your health through integrative medicine. Founded by NEPA native Louis Helmecki, Elevation Wellness offers physician-formulated and guided treatments that are administered by registered nurses. To learn more about how you can experience the benefits of IV vitamin therapy, multivitamin booster shots, non-invasive aesthetics, or peptide, NAD, red light, and compression therapy, visit elevation-wellness.com or follow them on Instagram at elevationwellnessNEPA. All On The Stacks listeners will receive 10% off their first purchase with code STACKS at checkout. Call 570-762-9400 or visit elevation-wellness.com to book your appointment today. Elevation Wellness, taking your health to new heights. This episode is brought to you by Burn, the fitness company behind the Today Show approved Burn Board. If I'm being honest, working out can be a real chore, especially as a new dad in desperate need of sleep and cardio. Burn is founded by NEPA native Jimmy T. Martin, and his Burn Board offers a low-impact core and cardio experience unlike anything I've done before. They have hundreds of on-demand workouts that are great for beginners, seasoned athletes, and out-of-shape podcast hosts who love supporting small businesses. My wife and I use it pretty frequently throughout the week, and it's honestly a great way to burn a ton of calories without burning a ton of cash. Not to mention, it's a great tool for skiers, runners, wrestlers, and hockey players. Jimmy is offering all On The Stacks listeners 15% off when they use the code STACKS15. Visit theburn.com today to get 15% off your purchase with code STACKS15 at checkout. Again, that's theburn, THEBRRN.com to get 15% off your purchase with code STACKS15. It's time to get on board today with Burn.
We drive the same roads you drive. We face the same danger you face. When you're involved in a car or a truck crash, it's personal. Because we live here and raise our families here. We're invested here.
To learn more, visit Anzalone Law Offices online at anzalonelaw.com.
And now we're back on the Stacks.
Yeah, so, you know, Logan Circle, well, DC is a diverse city anyway. I mean, for most of its history, it's been predominantly African-American, and I think it's closer to 50-50 at this point. Logan Circle, our second teammate that we hired, was in recovery, a recovery program at the Whitman Walker Addiction Services program down the street from that first store. He was recovering from crystal meth addiction. And Whitman Walker itself had started in the 80s to service, to help gay men suffering with AIDS, from AIDS. It was built during the AIDS epidemic. And so that alone made Logan Circle even more interesting because it was, from a sexual orientation standpoint, it was very diverse. a lot of the folks who were coming in to apply for jobs were gay men going to that clinic. And so we started out with that, that diversity on our books. The neighborhood had fallen apart and had just been crappy for decades with drug dealers and prostitution and all sorts of nefarious characters living in Logan Circle. Well, they were still there. And when they wanted to get a job, where were they going to go? They were going to go to the hardware store because we were one of the only businesses. There were many others that started opening around the same time, but we were just, I mean, one, it was a cool place to work, of course, but you know, you didn't have to be polished to work at a hardware store. You didn't have to have any kind of degree to work at the hardware store. And so we started from a place of let's hire the people who are in the community, who's in the community. And that's, it went from there.
Mm-hmm. So like when you were hiring these people, as you, like, as you just mentioned, like you didn't really need to be polished. Right. So like what, you know, as you were hiring some of these people, like what did you look for in people? Like what were some of the, you know, maybe you had a certain question or two that like just you really sticks in your head that maybe you would ask everybody. And that was kind of like the tell all type question. Or was there anything like that for you that, you know, when you asked a certain question or based on what somebody said that was kind of like a deciding factor for you in terms of hiring?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we had a lot of trial and error for lots of times, but I told you about the story for the 14-year-old. We said, tell us about a time you were a good neighbor. Well, be a good neighbor is one of our core values. And so if I were talking to you and I had never met you before, you can tell a lot about how somebody like gets excited to talk about a neighbor, or, you know, if they say they want to live in the woods and not have any neighbors, I mean, they're probably not going to want to help the lady in the hardware aisle.
No, not going to be good with people.
Yeah, no. So the other thing too is Washington, D.C. and Baltimore, to some extent, have not traditionally been known for having good customer service. And so we would talk a lot to the prospective applicants about how they are treated when they go into businesses and how they wished they were treated and how they would do it differently. And you can glean a lot from asking those kinds of questions too. So I always said that you don't have to be a professional to work in the hardware store. You just have to be professional. And that means something different to everybody, but you can still get to some commonalities, if you will. We had, so funny aside, like during COVID, we had to limit how many people could come into the store at a time. And I remember saying to one of my teammates, who do you know that's out of work that's really nice? And he said, I have a friend who's a bouncer. And the very next day we hired 13 bouncers,
one for every store,
because bouncers are just, they stand at, you know, they've got a good presence. They stand, they don't want to move around. Like I needed people who wanted to run around the hardware stores. They wanted to stand at the door and they're always nice to the people standing in line. And so it was a really good way to incorporate values into kind of a weird job description for a hardware store. And we got to find an underemployed population at the time and give them a job.
Yeah. So what were the other core values?
Always grow and share, which is really great because we have 25,000 items in our store. Be nice, which again is a little bit different for everyone, but usually everyone can articulate some kind of be nice. Communicate respectfully, which also means something different if you grew up having your parents scream at you all the time. But you, again, how would you like to be spoken to? How did your nicest teacher speak to you? And embrace and drive change, which is also very important because one, technology was coming at us fairly quickly and it's an old fashioned business. And so we wanted to modernize because we were in the city. Products were changing all of the time. New customers were coming in, moving into Logan Circle all the time. And so where you might have known all of the customers for the first year, all of a sudden we had attorneys who were buying places there, or we didn't have a lot of children in Logan Circle at the time. And so somebody would come in with kids and we were like, oh my God, what do we do with this kid? Like, we haven't had anyone under that, you know, age of 20 in the store ever. And so embracing and driving change is a big deal.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, and talking about innovation and things like that too. So I'm curious in terms like how, you know, as the years went by, like how, you know, you were able to adapt and grow and innovate and really, you know, as the area grew, how you've been able to continually grow as a business.
Yeah. So I used to say that I would wake up with a chip on my shoulder every day because our competitors are always faster, richer, stronger, smarter, better regulations on their side. You name it. You know, we were just like the small fry. And I have a teammate whose name is also Mark, who came from the clinic as well. And he was very reticent to change. And he did all of our inventory ordering and he had a clipboard. And he would go around the store to 25,000 items every week. And he would write down how many he thought we needed to buy. I mean, it took all damn week just to do one full cycle. And then we would order the items. Yeah. And they, yeah, exactly. So 20 years later, Mark still works on our team. He manages all of the inventory for all of the stores. And he basically does it with a push of the of a button. But he was very afraid to change. And I remember saying to him once, I am going to have to fire you if you don't start using this technology. And he didn't want to lose his job. I didn't want to fire him. I mean, he knew that. But the train was coming. We had to figure out how to be faster, or the competitors were going to run over us. And so that was a really big one. And then, you know, the onslaught of e-commerce was a little bit slow. Like, we knew it was coming, and Ace as a co-op certainly helped us out. So I don't feel like that hit us over the head. I think it also helped that we were in a city, because we were much more technology savvy. We were much more online ordering focused than some of my counterparts, maybe in the middle of the country or in more rural areas. Like, we were able to adapt that stuff fairly quickly.
Yeah. Yeah. I imagine, you know, like, you know, being in the city, fast paced, like you said, you probably at least had a little bit more access to, you know, to the, I'll say, like, the newest technologies, you know, yes. I totally understand, because, where I'm from, my hometown, we're a very small, small town, we're only a few hours from New York City. We're only a couple hours from, Philadelphia type thing. But, it's like a whole nother world going from, like, here to the big city. And I understand. Yeah. I've seen both sides. I've never lived out in any of those cities, but, prior to me, doing this, the podcast and the media work that I do now, I worked in my family's business for 12 years in outside sales. And part of my territory was New York City and Philadelphia. Oh, okay. So I was always, I've been exposed for the last, 15 years of being, being in these cities, regularly, almost, every other week, and, seeing, and just learning from, all these, my clients that I've worked with over the years. And I it's very similar. Like, I go to these bigger cities and you see so much more happening at such a faster pace, and they'd be so much far ahead. And I try to bring these ideas and things back home, and everybody's like, what are you talking about?
Like
all freaked out. And, but I think it served me well, because, even though, like I said, I in my hometown, I'll say we're maybe a little bit behind the times. Right. But, because of my experience and the connections and the relationships that I've built with individuals, outside of our town in these bigger cities, I've been tapped into, that aspect of, even though right here we may not be in the city, but I've been tapped into the networks of the people that are, and I've been able to, rely on them and talk to them and experience a lot of it firsthand. Like I said, I've spent so much time, in these cities around some of these bigger businesses that just, they move a lot faster. And, but then also, then comes red tape with some bigger businesses too, as I'm sure you've experienced that as well. But, as you being locally owned, you also get to, move as fast as you want or as slow as you
want. Exactly.
And it could be a blessing, and a curse, but at the same time, and I think during COVID, I think it proved itself well for a lot of smaller businesses, even though, unfortunately a lot of them may not be around anymore or have shrunk significantly. However, I think a lot of the smaller businesses and maybe family owned ones were immediately able to adapt and maybe do something a little bit different because they didn't have a lot of that red tape and they weren't, the big corporations, whatever. So I think they were able to just, you could just change course like so much faster and be able to implement change things without having to go through 10 layers of approvals and et cetera and so on. But so I think, there's pros and cons to it all. But like I said, being able to, I feel like I've kind of sort of had almost the best of both worlds where, I've been able to see both sides, of the fence of like you said, the technology and being like tapped into a bigger city and bigger network.
That exposure is everything. I remember I was at an event a couple of years ago and there was a futurist speaking, and he said that everything that happens on the coasts takes at least 2 years to make it to the middle of the country. And so a lot of those, the brands in particular that start in LA or San Francisco or New York, they're not showing up. And I think there's a rate of acceleration that has started to happen, but some of those things just didn't make it to the middle of the country fast enough, or they're still not making it there fast enough. And so, it can be a little scary on the outside, but we are seeing, you know, we see those trends and stuff faster. When I started in 2003, there was this, a retailer from Sacramento, and he had figured out that a big percentage of the hardware store owners weren't changing their prices. And there wasn't a sophisticated technology at the time that would allow us to do this. It was still fairly manual, but he created this, it wasn't even software. It was just like this program he would run in Excel, I think, that would take all of your items and it would tell you what your costs are in conjunction with what you were selling the products for, which again, this happens right now at a flip of a switch. But, and then he started going around the country doing these road shows. And so like he would come to your hardware store and he would say, Bill, you have left $95,000 on the table this year because you're selling your stuff below cost. Oof. And then he would go to the next retailer. I mean, I'm not lying. Some of those folks were losing like $500,000 a year. Wow. Because they were selling stuff less than they were buying it for. And just keeping up with all of that can be exhausting. And that's a lot easier now than it was then. You still have to pay attention. But I remember thinking, like, this is a good lesson for me as a new person in this business. There's so many things to think about, and you never, ever want to be selling your stuff for less than you're paying for it. you can screw some other things up, but do not screw that up.
Yeah, definitely not. But, you know, as I think, and we've all experienced it to some degree, you know, as business owners, is, you know, as you start to grow and expand, you know, sometimes we lose sight of some of those things, and you might just kind of be like, ah, it's just a couple bucks. Like you kind of just ignore it sometimes. But like, even though we know we shouldn't, but a lot of times you're like, ah, I'll get to that like next week. And then that just turns into next week and next week and next week.
Next month.
And then soon enough, you got, you know, that gentleman showing up saying, hey, you just lost $100,000. And we're like, huh? Like, what? Wait, wait, what happened here? You know, it sometimes, you know, as you grow, sometimes, you know, I mean, I am like a detail oriented person, but sometimes there are some things and some details that we sometimes just overlook, and it's just unfortunately it is what it is. But I think, you know, a lot of times we have to take a step back and really dive back into the basics, I'll say.
I also think that, you know, at least for me, because I knew nothing, right? I had never run a retail business. I didn't know anything about hardware. I didn't grow up in a retail family. I think there were these moments in time when I would say, when is an adult going to come save me? So I think I was 32 when I started the first store. So I wasn't a kid by any means, but I would still say, where's the adult? And so the practice that led us to was like actually hiring people that we called adults throughout the history. Like three times we hired business coaches. And that seemed like such a luxury when we did it, but we did it when we had a specific task that we needed to fix. And we thought, this business coach might give us this fix or help us get to that fix. And then pricing, we've hired outside consultants for a couple different things. Same thing, like we think we're doing a really good job, but lest we get too cocky, let's figure out if we really are by having a real adult come tell us. And we have learned something every single time, every time.
Yeah, you know, I love that concept, because I think a lot of people undervalue yes. You know, and you know, even, you know, now you're saying this, it's kind of making me start to think about myself too, and it's like, now I want to go hire somebody like right now.
Do you need an adult in your life?
I think I might Gina. I think I might need somebody to hold me accountable here. But it's so true. You know, we get so busy, and we get so caught up in you know, say, running the business and growing it and everything that is involved in it, and sometimes we don't hold ourselves accountable as much as we should. And again, sometimes it could just be stuff that's out of sight, out of mind, but then it just might be other stuff that we just don't like to do. And because we don't like to do it, we neglect it. And then when we neglect those things, it becomes a problem. And
that's exactly right.
Yeah. Yes. And, you know, I don't care how good you are. I mean, everybody, I think, has experienced it to some degree and or will at some point, even if anyone's listening or watching, it's like, oh no, I'm good. That's not going to happen to me. No, it
I'm too smart for that.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I always believe in just continually learning and just always being a student, because I think when we get too comfortable and think that, oh, either we know it all or we have it figured out, like there's always something changing, whether it's technology, there's always, you know, I don't want to say there's a monster lurking in the background that's just going to come and take over. But at the same time, and I don't know about you, but something you said earlier kind of reminded me of it, but I kind of a lot of times operate with like almost like this little bit of like a paranoia. Like paranoia, yeah. Like somebody, like so, like you got to keep working, like somebody's going to take your business away from you, because if you don't, yes. If you don't have that attitude, somebody is going to take your business away from you.
That is well, I mean, I gave a speech this week and I said, think about Polaroid or Blockbuster or BlackBerry or Sears. Like
right.
Those were iconic billion-dollar companies. And I mean, it was probably a bunch of stuff that led to their demise. But, you know, I, as a small business, I've said, we get stuck in our four walls. And for us, it's literally a brick and mortar. So if I don't go out on the street and see, like, what are our neighbors doing? What are our competitors doing? What are they doing in that industry that might work in my industry? Like, I can't just think hardware is where it's at. I can't just go to a hardware convention and see what the same old people are doing in the same old industry. Like, I want to know what's happening at the fashion shows or the pet shows or the technology events, because that, well, one, it's going to keep us busy or interesting, and it's going to keep us on our toes, because you know, those big box stores, they're everywhere. And yeah. Online retailers have more money than we do. They'll always have more money than we do.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah. So I want to talk about your book a little bit. So, Recovery Hardware, you know, it just came out a couple years ago, and it's business growth and lessons that you've learned from hiring folks in recovery. And I think that's such an interesting, you know, I'd love to hear a little bit more about it, and you know, maybe not give too much away, so you know, our you know, listeners and viewers can maybe pick it up themselves. But take me through that a little bit.
Yeah, so Mark, who I told you had the clipboard that did the inventory manually, he came to me one day, it was 2014, and he said, hey, the community has started calling this place Recovery Hardware. And I bald. I mean, there's a chapter in the book called There Are No Tears in Hardware, because it's kind of our unwritten motto. But I thought that was such a beautiful nickname, because ever since we opened, we had been hiring people from that recovery clinic. We never had a formal program. We didn't tell them that we were going to hire the people in their program. It just happened in a really nice organic way. And then apparently the community recognized it. And so people had wanted me for years to write a book. And I was like, no one needs to read a book about a chick owning a hardware store. Like, that's not interesting. And then as soon as he said that name, I was like, I'm going to talk about the people who have taught me how to build this business, basically. And so I started telling the stories of some of the more impactful. I mean, I think all of my teammates have made an impact on the business, but you know, you can only tell so many stories. And so really it went from growing up with some entrepreneurial spirit in my family's household through building the business and some of the pain along the way, the challenges, the failed stores, people who started using drugs again and broke my heart, people who never used drugs or went to jail in their life who stole from us and broke my heart. I mean, it's the whole litany of things, which culminated in us selling the business to our team through an employee stock ownership plan that was not in the works when I started writing the book. And it became this beautiful bow to wrap it all up, because somewhere in the process, I knew that I wanted to leave as CEO. And we also knew that we wanted to keep the businesses in the hands of our team in the communities that supported us. And an ESOP was the way to do that. So the book is really that journey and the lessons that I learned along the way.
Yeah. So the it was that first employee, was that the one that had the felony? Is that the one you're referring to?
No, that was Tommy. Mark with the clipboard was employee number three.
Okay. So he came from the recovery center?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay.
He was also in recovery for crystal meth addiction and alcoholism. And so he started working with us, and he referred somebody who referred somebody who referred somebody. And so that's how it happened, all very organically. And then along the way, you know, there were all sorts of other people that we were hiring who didn't come from the clinic or hadn't been in prison or, you know, had different backgrounds. But he was very instrumental in us getting started. Obviously, he stayed and runs all of our inventory now. And then has, you know, a lot of our folks are still very, very active in the recovery community. And it was his friends, I think, that were calling the place Recovery Hardware. So
yeah. Do you know about how many you've hired from the recovery community?
Nope. We've never counted. There have been quite a few people who have joked that we could have an AA meeting in the plumbing department. I don't keep track, so I have no idea.
Yeah.
Just, yeah.
Yeah. Right.
But yeah, so it's been quite a few. And it's not, it's never been a mandate. The managers don't have a requirement to hire from any of the agencies that we've worked with over the years. But because we created those core values, and a lot of the managers in the beginning were employees who then went on to become managers, they took those values with them. And so a lot of the other stores of the 13 have the same kind of mentality, basically.
Yeah. What is it? What is it about? And I find this to be very common with a lot of individuals that are in recovery. I've had like several guests on my show here before that, you know, are some type of recovering addict, and I've often found, you know, once they're clean and sober, they're very, a lot of them are entrepreneurial. The drive they have is like better than anyone. Hardworking, yep. just everything. Everyone that I've had on that's been in recovery is now extremely successful. And yeah. I found that very common within the community. I mean, have you seen the same thing?
Absolutely. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of resiliency. The opposite of addiction is connection. And when you can figure out how to connect with whatever community you want to work with, I think that connection can lead to really amazing things. Because, you know, going back to that felony box, a lot of people wouldn't be hired if they had to admit, or if someone did a background check and found out that they had alcoholism in their past, or they had taken 3 months off from work. Well, why did you take that time off? And so a lot of folks became entrepreneur out of necessity. But I think there's an incredible amount of hard work, like a strong work ethic, because you want to be busy. You don't want to be thinking about doing something that you shouldn't be doing, you know, something that's unhealthy for you. There's a lot of resiliency. I never thought about it this way, but several of the folks who worked with us in recovery said, I never wanted to let you down because you gave me a chance. So I think, yeah, there's just, I Shane, who is one of my friends who worked with us early on, he's been clean for 21 years now. He said, you know, when we go to AA meetings, we're basically in therapy. And so he has said on more than one occasion, they have for decades that they're in living a clean life, they're going to meetings that are basically therapeutic. And so I feel like that has helped a lot of my teammates speak more respectfully, be a lot calmer than those of us who haven't had those experiences, be very in touch with their emotions and aware of like just be aware of what everyone around them is feeling.
Talk about empathy here, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
This is the ultimate empathy right here.
Yes. That is exactly right. So, I mean, I don't want to make it sound glorified because nobody wishes to go through recovery so that they get these skills, but it's worked, whatever's worked.
Yeah. Yeah. And I have to find too, like, you know, whatever it is that anyone's been through in life, whether it's been addiction or not, or it just any other type of trauma, I'll say, right? Yes. It's usually when once somebody's really broken down to like nothing and then they build themselves back up, they, you know, most people come back like 1,000 times stronger. And yeah. I love to see it. I mean, I who doesn't love a good underdog story, first of all?
Oh, right? Exactly.
I mean, you know, like even yourself, I mean, I see a little bit of that kind of in your story, just because, you know, again, going back to your early beginnings, a female business owner, female in a male dominated industry. I mean, everything about it just kind of has a little bit of that underdog feel, and you gotta, you know, for you to be able to like climb that ladder and just build out and get the respect and everything else. I mean, I know it wasn't hard. I mean, I can't speak to it because, you know, I've never been in your shoes, but just from, you know, a little bit that you've shared and just knowing the challenges that, you know, the challenges that I do know that you've faced and everything that you've gone through to be able to build this business and your team. And it sounds like you have such a love and appreciation for your team, which is awesome. I love that because I think acknowledging and having the team around you, and you said it earlier about, you know, the team helping build what you have, is so important. Yeah. And I think that's really crucial, especially nowadays. It's because anyone can just pretty much get a job anywhere nowadays, and loyalty is a little, maybe a little few and further in between nowadays. So it's harder and harder every day, but I can appreciate everything about your story and your team and the people.
Thanks.
I love to see it. I love to hear it. Plus, like I said, I also love a story of somebody who built something that other people may have just looked at it and be like, ah, that's not possible. She can never do that.
Can't do it. So the Collins Dictionary, I'm going to geek out on you for a second. The Collins Dictionary describes a long shot as something that probably won't succeed, but it's worth trying. And that little sliver, it's worth trying, makes everything possible. Like maybe I have a little bit of a gambling spirit, but I'm like, damn it. If there's like the smallest chance that this is going to work, I'm going to give it a try. Like, screw that whole probably won't succeed baloney. I went through this really amazing public speaking program last year, and we had to create our big idea. And the big idea didn't have to be new. It just had to be what we were going to frame the speech around. And what I ultimately settled on was, just because the world underestimates us doesn't mean our fate is pre-written. Because every single person that came to work for us, 90% of us, were underestimated in some way, shape, or form. A chick shouldn't own a hardware store. Someone with 17 years in prison shouldn't be helping the public. Someone with a crystal meth addiction. But I'll, you name it. Like, we heard every negative about all of the things we were going to try to do. But our fate, it didn't seal our fate. We still figured out a lot of really cool things.
Yeah, that's incredible. I love it. I love stories like that. I feel like I operate with that same mentality of just, you know, always feel like, you know, you're people underestimate you, right? And people, a lot of people just tend to write you off. And yep. But you know, you just like you said, if there's even if there's just a sliver of a chance, like, you know, just yep. like in Dumb and Dumber, what does he say? So you're saying there's a chance, right?
But my mom loves to play bingo. So that's all my bingo equation will be your Dumb and Dumber. Like, I might get the winning number.
Yeah, right. Just like you said, even if nobody else sees it or thinks it's possible, you know, you just having that slight, you know, sliver of, hey, like, there might be a chance, and I'm going to try it. And yep. I think, you know, a lot of people are too afraid to maybe take a risk or take a chance, especially if it's something that maybe has even a smaller of a chance of succeeding.
And you never know.
Yeah.
Right. You never know. Somebody emailed me the other day and she said, I have a business that I'm going to start, but I want you to tell me how you think I can minimize the risk. And so, you know, I walked her through some academic, like, ask yourself this, answer this question, have you done this? And then at the very end, I said, but if you believe in this idea, you just have to do it. Like, all of that other stuff is bullshit. Because if you believe in it, you can never, ever minimize all of the risk. You might still lose your money or go out of business. But if you believe in it, you just have to try it. I mean, I don't know how else to answer that. I mean, if you're doing something really stupid, yeah, I can walk you through thinking about it. But yeah, I mean, that's how all of the really fancy or big successful businesses have been born. Somebody that's just had a wild, crazy idea and is like, I'm going to do this. And then it works.
Yeah. No matter what somebody says or does, no matter how many times you're beaten up, or, and like you said, like the money thing, like, yeah, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
You know, money isn't everything. Like, you could always make it back. You know, yep. Obviously, you know, yep. You know, sometimes you might lose a little bit more than others, but it's, you know, when you look at it, it's just like you said, if it's something that you really believe in, just nothing else really matters. Just go do yeah. that thing. And I think if you take that mindset of just head down and move forward, I think the money will follow. You know, obviously you have to do a lot of the right things along the way, and, you know, it's going to go like this. It's not going to be just straight upward. But I think just continuing along that path and just doing the thing, no matter what anybody else says, and just block all that out. And, you know, I often find, you know, too, it's usually sometimes the people that are closest to you will be the ones to talk you out of it.
Than
people who don't know you, you know? So I always encourage everybody, you know, don't take advice. And I'm sure you know this quote, like, don't take advice from somebody that's never done the thing that you're trying to do. Number one.
Right.
And then, right. you know, not saying don't talk to your parents or siblings or, you know, people closest to you, for sure. Do that. But sometimes you got to consider the source, and, you know, as much as, you know, somebody close to you might have, you know, may have good advice or not, like, sometimes you really maybe need to go outside of your immediate circle of family and friends and get somebody else's advice that, you know, even if they're not in the same industry, but they've yeah. done something similar to what you're trying to do, you know, their advice and what they can share with you, you know, a lot of times may be better than somebody that's just closer to you who's just gonna say, I don't know, that's a little risky, I don't know if you should do that, Bill. You know what I mean?
Yes. Yeah. Well, I think you have to be able to see the possibility too. Like, I got off stage the other day, and I had been thinking before I went up there, it was an all female audience for an entrepreneurial center at Westchester University. And I was thinking, like, why is this impact? Like, what am I going to get out of being on stage? Because I think the speaker needs to get something out of it too. And why is this important for the people in the audience? No, like, again, it's a hardware store. Like, what impact am I going to make? People want to see someone who's been successful, and they want to see themselves as that success. You said it. It doesn't matter what the industry is, but they want to know that no matter how crazy the scheme could be, the idea, no matter how, you know, circuitous the route, is that the right word, could be, that somebody did it. And oh my gosh, that could be me too. And I got off the stage and I had all these women who wanted to talk to me and had questions and they wanted to hear more about the story. And I thought, this is why you talk about building, even if it's a brick and mortar hardware business, because people want to know that it's possible.
Yeah.
I had two clients this year that hired me that said, I want you to talk about struggles. And I will tell you that I'm very bad at talking about the hard stuff. I often really sugarcoat it. I only bring up all the real positives. And when the first CEO asked me that, I was like, well, what the hell am I going to say? Like, just because I wrote about them, but they don't immediately come to mind. And I started thinking about those two stores that failed. And I was like, all right, I've got stories. I mean, kind of pretend they never happened, but they did. What am I going to talk about with those two stores being a struggle? Like one of them, for example, and both times we asked the entire team which other store they wanted to go to because we didn't want to get rid of any of our teammates. And in one of the locations, about 90% of the team decided to stay and go work in other stores. And within about 3 months, they had all quit. Like we had just changed the dynamic of their work life so much that they couldn't handle the change. And that was really painful for me. I wanted them to stay. But you can't minimize everything.
Yeah. Yeah. And you also like, kind of also to that point, like you can't force, like if somebody is like, as much as you're like, oh, but no, but you're a good fit for this. Like, no, like we want you to stay. It's like at the end of the day, that person, you know, trying not to force something like that, it ends up being worse for you after, you know, than it does. I mean, you might be the greatest salesperson in the world and maybe you'll be able to talk, you know, that person into doing this or that or to stay or whatever. But you know, I found that a lot of times you end up doing more harm than good, and not just really letting that person go. So I think sometimes we just need to let go.
The interesting thing about that is, so, you know, we broke up their nuclear family, if you will. And so they had different managers and they were working with a different team. But for me, they were at the same company. So if you were that person in that situation and you said, I just can't handle this change, I'm going to quit, you still had to go get a job somewhere with a different boss and a different team. But I think the fresh start at a new company eliminated the memories of what they had before the store failed or what they had mm-hmm. with a different family. But that was really hard for me because I thought, oh, they love us. It doesn't matter where they are, but that's not the truth.
Yeah.
So it was good. They were hard lessons, but it was probably a good thing that I had been asked those questions and then had an opportunity to really talk through them because otherwise I come on a podcast and everything's rosy, which is not the case.
right. Yeah. Especially not in the entrepreneurship world, right?
No, of course not. And not in a brick and mortar retail business. I mean, we're getting slammed.
Yeah. Yeah. You're getting beat up all the time.
All the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, all right. So if anyone, you know, listening, watching wants to learn more about you, get your, you know, read your book, you know, your speaking, like where do they need to go? How can people connect with you?
I'm on LinkedIn at Gina Schaefer. I hope there's some show notes with the crazy spell
sure.
right there, the spelling of my name. I'm on Instagram at Gina Schaefer DC. So those are mostly my two social media platforms. My book is for sale on my website, which is ginaschaefer.com. Or, I mean, you can buy it at any of the major retailers. I often sort of encourage people to buy it at bookshop.org for their local bookstore, because that's who will get credit if they have a local bookstore that they like to support. So it's available. I've been really fortunate to sell lots and lots of copies and get to tell lots of stories of like Tommy and Mark and all of the fun people who came through our doors.
Yeah, some incredible stories. I appreciate you sharing some of them and
sure.
and being vulnerable. Like you said, like the hard lessons that you learn, you know, sometimes it might be the hardest to talk about because, as you said, like it's that uncomfortable, like, oh, well, what'd you learn from it? And sometimes, like you said, you may have blocked it out so much because you're like, oh, I hate that. It kind of takes you back to that low point. But at the same time, you know, as somebody's asking, like, you know, usually there's a lot to be learned from that. So I appreciate you, you know, opening up and, you know, being vulnerable and sharing some of those things. I think there's a lot to be learned.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I had he's a mentor. He is an older gentleman in the co-op world. He runs a radio show called Everything Co-op. And one day he told me that I lead by cheerocracy. And I had never heard that word before, but I think that really sums up my over cheerful visual of the last 21 years.
I love it. I love it. Oh, and yeah. I'd be remiss if I didn't give a shout out to Laura Mai, who yes. actually introduced us. I can't believe we're a whole hour into the show, and I had her on my mind a couple times. I'm like, oh, I gotta give her a shout out. So I just want to make sure
she'll appreciate it.
Yeah, give Laura a shout out for introducing us. So shout out to Laura. Thank you.
Perfect.
Yeah. Well, hey, it was great hopping on here and chatting with you today, and. You know, I look forward to, just watching and continue to see you do some awesome things. And, I appreciate it. And, maybe in the near future, we can have you back on.
That'd be awesome. Thank you so much.
All right. Gina Schaefer on the Stacks in the Sweat 10 studio. Thanks for joining me. If you want to see more On the Stacks content, subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/onthestackspodcast or search the hashtag On the Stacks on Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn.